Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today I'm going to be talking to a subject which should be fascinating, connectomes. And you're thinking, what on earth is a connectome? Well, we have an expert on that in the studio today, Professor Larry Swanson. He's a professor of biological sciences at the University of Southern California. And Larry, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. This is my first visit to El Paso.
Oh, that's all right.
Got in yesterday afternoon, and I've had a fabulous time. Went up on the scenic drive last night at sunset, looked out over the city.
All right. Well, that's why people come here. They come here to talk science and look at the view. Before we get on to connectomes, and I'm dying to find out what this is all about, tell us a little bit about Larry Swanson. I mean, you're a scientist. You're a professor of biological science. How did that come about? When was it that you were told or understood that you were going to be a scientist?
You know, I'm not sure I could ever pinpoint anything. I was always interested in things in rocks and animals and plants and all. But I decided in college that I wanted to be a chemistry major.
Very sensitive.
And I took chemistry, and this was back in California, and I grew up in Las Vegas, which when I flew into El Paso, the desert and the mountains looked the same to me. It was really a nice feeling. But I went to California, and between my sophomore and junior years, they got me to do some research in chemistry. And I have to admit, I hated it.
Just come to such a definitive conclusion about chemistry. And remember, there are millions of people listening.
Yes.
What did you do? What was the little research that you did?
Well, so the reason, yes, it wasn't chemistry so much as my professor there at college gave me a drop of pine tar from a pine tree and wanted me to spend the summer separating out all the different molecules that were in the pine tar. And so it was one of these Rube Goldberg-type things of all these glass apparatus all over the room and everything. And
oh, so you had to do an extraction in water,
extraction,
in acid, base.
All of this
All the variation on a drop.
On a drop. And I don't think I was quite ready for that, actually. So the next semester, you know, by chance, I was at a small liberal arts college where they wanted you to take a lot of stuff. And I took a course in psychology, and they called it like biological. It was sort of biological psychology. And I thought, wow, that is really interesting, you know, figuring out sort of how the brain works, you know, and how our behavior, what does the brain have to do with all of this?
And pine tar was in the rearview mirror forever.
Pine tar just, that did it. And I thought, you know, I was thinking at the time, I just didn't get the significance of the pine tar. But I did think, you know, I could actually do some research or figure something out. I just had this feeling that I could do this psychology, the biology research.
Right.
And so when I applied for grad school, I applied for programs in this new field called neuroscience, which was sort of a new way to study the brain. So that's how I got started.
And it's coming back into vogue really quite big because of, you know, the federal government wants to find out more about how it is we think in between our ears, right?
How we think. And, you know, a big thing now is this horrible Alzheimer's disease problem with, you know, so many of us getting older. As scientists, we're pretty sure this is something that we can find a solution for in the next 5 or 10 years, I think, unlike some other mental health problems that are much more difficult. So I think in the United States, President Obama started a brain initiative.
Right.
And it was really focused on figuring out the wiring diagram of the brain and what goes wrong with dementia, let's say, you know, which is such a – and the other big thing, of course, is the post-traumatic stress was the other part of what the president really wanted to focus on, a brain disease.
Let's just briefly – I'll ask the question. Alzheimer's and dementia in general, the implication is that this is a sort of a 21st century sort of problem. But is it simply that – on a naive basis, that we're redefining dementia and that we're living longer, and so it becomes more apparent that we all know somebody, maybe even ourselves? Or is it really an epidemic that is caused by something more fundamental?
You know, I'm not an expert. I don't know the answer for sure, but I think a big part of it is that we're living longer and we can now call it something, whereas maybe our grandparents, as they got really old, started, you know, having problems in their daily life. But now we say, well, they're getting Alzheimer's. And there's a lot of different forms of dementia, actually, that get lumped all together. But there's a chemical problem, and we don't know what causes it, but it makes these deposits in your brain that you can see, you know, under the microscope or in a brain scan. So it's a physical thing that's happening.
So nowadays you can go in and have a CAT scan or something like that, and they can tell you what percentage of...
Well, if it's advanced enough, you know, and they'd like to...
It's too late, obviously.
Almost. And, you know, I'm not a neurologist, but the problem right now is with diagnosis, there's not a whole lot you can do about it, you know, even if you know you have it.
Well, I mean, let me just interject then, because you see all of these different advertisements for different intellectual games. I've forgotten the name of this company, Luminosity, I think it is. And I'm not advertising, I'm just sort of bringing up a name. But where practice to do things with your brain surely would be the same as practicing with your muscles, and therefore is not necessarily, it's hopeless that when you begin to get those first signs, whatever they are, then maybe some intellectual games would be appropriate.
It absolutely can't hurt, and I think you're right. I think staying mentally active and physically active is great. I saw this with my mother. She went through all of this, and when it got to the point that she didn't watch TV anymore, or read the newspaper, you know, and just sort of lost interest in things,
yes,
things went downhill really fast.
How old was she, if
well,
I
she
may
was,
ask?
She was... I would say in her late 80s.
Okay, so not that old, in a sense.
Really, in a sense. Everything, physically, she was okay, actually. But it was this inactivity where...
Did that have any impact upon your interest in the area?
Well, I think it did. This didn't happen that long ago, but I think this is why a lot of young people, neuroscience is a really booming field, and it's because everybody has somebody in their family with some kind of mental health problem. I mean, it's so common.
Right.
And it's so difficult on people, on the people involved in the family and all. And yet, a lot of people don't want to really talk about it and deal with it in a straightforward way.
Well, society's never been very good at dealing with the people who are, I don't say mentally deficient, just distinctive. Different, think to a different drummer and things like that. And we don't know what to do with them.
Yeah, and it's, you know, there are obviously medically cases where people are really devastated by some of these brain diseases. But many people on the border or just different, we're having a hard time figuring out. I hope that's gradually changing in our society, that there's more acceptance.
Well, of course, the problem with that is we're discovering more and more people who fit that category, right?
True.
I mean, and we may come back to that towards the end, but yeah. I want to get on to this word, connectome. What does it all mean? What is a connectome?
Well, probably the best way to – what the connectome is the wiring diagram of the brain.
Oh, so it's a circuit.
It's a circuit. What is the circuit of the brain, actually, which, believe it or not, we don't actually understand. But the reason that this is so important or is so popular at the moment is because of something that almost everybody's heard about, and that is the genome, which it was the first ome, sort of. And ome just means like a comprehensive or a complete knowledge of something in biology. And, you know, the genome was this huge effort to understand DNA. Well, it's really like it's almost like a language or a sentence. What is the sequence of your DNA, where all your genes are? This is really, it's your heredity, the genes. So back in the 90s, they decided a starting point would be to just understand the basic structure of DNA, which is all animals, all plants. It's like universal. And so the federal government spent about $3 billion figuring out the genome. And that has had huge, huge spinoffs because what it's really leading to is personalized medicine, where you can sort of see actually what is going to work for you.
That's the Holy Grail. Yeah, right. Instead of taking medication A, you've got A 1 through 26, and 22 is yours.
That's the one that's going to work for you.
Yes.
You know, and the reason is because this is your profile, you know. And so people are thinking now the next step is we've figured out to some extent how the genes work. The next step and the big step and the hardest step is figuring out how our brain works, which is our personality. It's us. And everybody knows the brain is the most complicated thing in the world. And oh my gosh, it's horrible. Billions of connections and circuits and everything else. But
and new ones can be made any moment, apparently.
Yes, there's
this plastic concept.
Yeah, when you learn, you know, or right. When you're under stress, things change. But the connectome is a little bit like saying, yes, that's true, but there's also a basic level that's sort of the same. It's like as if you talk about a person, you know, they have a head and a neck, two arms and two legs. You know, there's something common that you can start with, a skeleton, sort of. And so we want to sort of know what is that basic plan, the basic way that the brain works. And right now we just have little bits and pieces here and there. But we should actually go and just figure out, you know, have an effort to figure out what is the wiring diagram of the brain. And so connections. The brain is connections. And so it's a connectome. It's all of the connections of the brain.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest today is Larry Swanson. He's a professor of biological sciences at the University of Southern California, and we're talking about connectomes. So you just hang in there, and we'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm here with Larry Swanson, who is a professor of biological sciences at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. We're talking about the connectome. And so you're saying really that the connectome is going to be the most rudimentary circuit of what's going on in the brain. Now, I've read all sorts of articles, talked to people and seen pictures even, where nowadays we can put electrodes into the brain and we can give them a rose to smell and something lights up. You know, you can do almost anything nowadays in terms of tracing, as I understand it, pathways within the brain. So what you must have to deal with, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's just massive big data. So you've got to do the analysis of big data using computers and all the rest of it. Is that really where you're heading, or that's what I'm thinking you're heading?
I think you hit the nail on the head there. I've been doing this a long time, and I'm a biologist, and thinking about all of this, just in the last 5 or 10 years, my thinking has changed a lot. And what's changed people's thinking on all of this is the internet, because the internet is unbelievably complicated. It's got millions of connections, and it's all over the world, and it's dynamic, and it's moving. And so computer scientists actually are not totally intimidated by these big numbers and complexity. And they've figured out ways of analyzing networks, you know, that are mathematical. They're systematic and ways of seeing how networks are organized. So a big revolution in biology, I think, in neuroscience in the last 5 or 10 years has been in people's minds, wait a minute, maybe the brain's not too complicated to figure out. Maybe we can hook up with computer science and mathematicians and figure out not every tiny little detail, but we can figure out sort of at the higher level how it works, what the big parts are and how they interconnect.
So is this part of the subject that we tend to think of as bioinformatics?
I think it's a subdivision of bioinformatics, which pretty much grew out of this genomics we talked about before, where you had huge amounts of data about the DNA and different species and, you know, the DNA from different people, is different, just like the brain in different people. But it generated gigantic amounts, big data. And what generated even bigger data was Google and these companies that have massive amounts of information that they...
About us.
About us. And they figure out how to find it
and how to use
it and how to sell you stuff.
How often I get something to do with Australia, because I happen to try to buy Australia versus England cricket tickets on the internet, and all of a sudden someone out there has figured, way out here in West Texas, somebody interested in Australia. It's a bit insidious, actually.
It is, but they're figuring out how to mine big data, how to get information out of big data.
Right.
And the brain is really big data, but we're beginning to think it's manageable, you know, which is a big shift. And it's because of these new tools, I think, that came out of computer science, you know.
Let me ask you then, specifically, what is your role in this research area? I gather you're one of the founding fathers of this Connectome business. What is your current sort of contribution been in the past, and where do you think you're going to take that?
Well, I've been studying connections in the brain for like probably 30, 35 years. For very traditional biological approach, and I know a lot about connections, but just in the last 5 years, I began to see that we need to do this in a new way, not just the old biological way, but we need to actually think about all of this now as a system, as a network. And who has the tools to do that, really, but computer science, actually. And there's a whole new science called systems science, where you can look at the airline routes around the world. Where are the airports and what airplanes are flying where and how do you get where?
Right.
It's actually, we're analyzing the brain with the same tools. So for us, a part of the brain would be like a hub, you know.
Right.
And a really important hub, let's say, would be, I don't know, if you were JFK in New York, for example, huge number of flights coming in and out, you know. But the way the airline industry uses this network analysis to actually optimize everything and so on, and we're beginning to think about the brain as that kind of a network with hubs and connections, connectomics, connections between them, and see if we can't use those tools to actually. And then what we really do, if we have a wiring diagram, we say, here's sort of the standard pattern. Now, somebody with, let's say, depression or post-traumatic stress disorder, how does that pattern differ from sort of the normal standard pattern? And with this information, how could we get that different pattern back to sort of normal? And so it all of a sudden gives you clues on where to think about what kind of a drug could you design that would actually go in specifically to those changed parts and get them moved back towards the center. And all of a sudden, you can have a tool to see whether your drug is actually working or not. Because if you give the drug and you don't move the pattern back to where it should be, it's not really working. So this is a sort of a whole new approach to thinking about how to even diagnose really what kind of dementia it is, what would be the best treatment for that, how do we actually design a better treatment. So this is the sort of the future of I think even neurology, let's say.
Let's go to that different types of dementia. Alzheimer's is a very precise word that we use, but you implied that maybe there are many levels of dementia associated with Alzheimer's. Do they all have the deposition of plaques in the brain or?
No, there are different, Alzheimer, I mean, this was back in the 19th century, the doctor that
right.
first described this.
Was he the doctor or was he the patient?
No, he was
Alzheimer.
He was the doctor.
Okay.
He was the doctor, Alzheimer, Louis Alzheimer. He described it in people that were in their 50s. So it was early onset dementia, was Alzheimer's originally.
Right.
But these days, anybody that is, you know, shows signs of dementia, they just sort of say Alzheimer's. But there are different causes of dementia, many different causes, not just the plaques. And so
so what you're looking at is patterns in different
Parts
areas
of,
dementia, if you like, to be able to tease out the distinctions between the hub and the spoke, et cetera, in the connectivities. Yeah.
So, you know, a doctor, let's say a neurologist, well, one thing they'll do is look for different patterns of symptoms, you know, and you can separate out on symptoms. So what we'd like to do is say, with this set of symptoms versus that set of symptoms, what's the difference in the connectome?
Give us a couple of examples, scenarios, one set of dementia symptoms versus another set.
Well, you could look at it that way, or you could say every disease has a progression, and it starts off in one way, but Alzheimer's is a good example. It's got a slightly different pattern in every person, but it usually starts in sort of the same place and then starts spreading through the brain in different patterns. And so, you know, what you
Say that again. It starts in some other part of the body and
usually
then moves to the brain?
In the brain. No, it usually starts in one part of the brain.
Okay,
in the temporal
and then
lobe.
Spreads within the brain.
It's in the temporal lobe. It's in actually in the part of the brain we know is involved in storing short-term memories, actually, before they get into long-term. So people with Alzheimer's can oftentimes remember stuff from their childhood, for example, with no problem. Right. What happened yesterday or what happened 5 minutes ago?
Oh, where are your damn keys?
Yeah, where, where are your keys?
That one I know very well.
Yeah, so the point is that you could follow the progression of the disease in individual peoples by looking at the change in the connectome. I, off the top of my head, can't give you examples of two different types of dementia, but, you know, it's the one that everybody is thinking about now is autism spectrum disorder, where there are a lot of different symptoms involved, and everybody realizes that it's not one disease, but it's a mixture or a combination of different things.
And the other side to autism, if I can interject here, is this concept of the savant, right? I mean, where quite often those two things go together. They're not automatic, but there's a connectivity there, which is right up your alley, I guess.
So what is that connectivity? You know, this is what we want to know, basically. And if we had a map, a wiring diagram, you can, on your computer monitor, you can put that wiring diagram up, and then you can put another one up over it and see how they differ.
Yeah.
You know, what is the difference?
Well, it's exciting. I mean, if we're making that much progress, and you clearly think that, you mentioned earlier in the program, 5-10 years, and we'll be knowing infinitely more than we know now, maybe even enough to say, well, we've got a methodology to retard the onset of this particular type of dementia.
I think that's a reasonable thing. A lot of people are very hesitant to claim we're going to cure Alzheimer's in 10 years. But if we can make progress, you know, the brain is so – there are no short-term solutions. Nothing is going to happen overnight. Yeah. It's a very complicated problem. But I think over 10 years, 5-10 years is a reasonable thing. There's so many people involved now that, you know, there's hope.
There's hope. As the research population ages, they focus more on this particular project, I guess.
Absolutely.
We've only got a few minutes left, but the brain, that's the sort of sine qua non of a beautiful, well-constructed organism, and it does everything for us. It's the intelligence. But we're making more and more computers that have the capacity, you know, to think quicker than we will ever think. I don't think now anyone's beaten the latest computer at chess. And Stephen Hawking said just some time ago that one of the biggest worries he has is that we're going to be making machines, instruments, robots, I suppose, that outclass us in our own intelligence. And that can't lead anywhere once they start to reproduce to a, you know, it's a bit of science fiction, but you must think about this a little, I think.
I think about it somewhat, and my only real solution is we've got to stay one step ahead of those computers.
Ned Ludd said, the Luddites. You know, but he just broke the damn machines, right? So, but we can't do that.
No, we can't. This is a profound question, and you actually hit the nail on the head here, because right now we can unplug that machine, but what people are really aiming for is what they call autonomous robotic computers, really robots that can survive on their own, you know,
right.
Like organisms. And so if you unplug this computer, it knows where the plug is and will go and plug itself back in.
Just to sort of finish this scenario, we now have on the market cars that drive themselves. We have solar cars, so we don't need to stop at a gas station. They can just start doing their business without us. It should be the end of insurance companies, I would think, because, you know, there's never going to be any accidents. But, I mean, it's this future is right here almost.
And it's fast. It's been happening, this information revolution, digital revolution, whatever you want to call it. I remember, 10 or 15 years ago, before email, and before Google, and before a lot of this stuff, before even thinking about a self-driving car.
That's a lot of things to ponder, a lot of connectivities to make, and some to perhaps unmake. Larry Swanson, it's been a pleasure to have you here on Science Studio. As I said, we were talking to Professor Larry Swanson from the Department of Biological Sciences, University of Southern California. Fascinating topic you're into. Good luck with it. And I'd like to thank Dennis Wu and Norma Martinez this week for putting the program together. Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me.
We'll be back next week with another Science Studio, so don't go too far from the radio. Bye-bye.